Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, September 22nd, 2017. So I have been told this is the first day of autumn transitions. So I have been told we are not transitioning quite yet here at the Cows. We are doing our book club. Every Friday book club. This is France Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth, study session number 7 that we're reading this week. We only have 3 sessions left in the book. We are getting to the conclusion quickly. I think we would have been done already if I had not had so many back problems and teeth extractions and everything else that I had to deal with from last month. But feeling better and moving forward in the text. I said last week, I've been critical of the text the whole time we've been reading it. Even before we started reading it, I let people know that I, you know, did not have a high opinion of this text. And I said last week that I would put my criticism in context. I would give the full list of all of the books that we have read on the book club since we started doing our reading club back in the spring of 2012. It's been more than 5 years. So these are all the books that we have covered and in the order that we read them on the program. And then we'll get started with Mr. Frantz Fanon, Wretched of the Earth. So we started our book club back in 2012 with Yorugu, Dr. Marimba Ani. I think we read from her text last week. Then it was The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison. Then The Turner Diaries by Dr. William Pierce. Dreams from My Father, former President Barack Obama, that was next. 1984 by the late George Orwell. Next up was Warriors, Don't Cry, Melba Patillo Beals. Next we read Elizabeth and Hazel by David Margolick. Next was The Education of a British Protected Child, the late Chinua Achebe. Next, we read How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. Next up, one of my favorites, top 5 selection for Gus T. Renegade, The Warmth of Other Suns by the lovely Isabel Wilkerson. Next was 12 Years a Slave by Solomon Northup. Next, we read Long Walk to Freedom by the late Madiba Nelson Mandela. Next up, 2000 Seasons by Ayi Kwei Arma. Next, we read Getting Things Done by David Allen. Next, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings by the late Dr. Maya Angelou. Next, Black and White, The Way I See It, Richard Williams. Next up, we read The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks by Rebecca Skloot. Then we read American Sniper by Chris Kyle. Next was The Autobiography of Malcolm X as Told to Alex Haley. Then we read Asada, an autobiography by the late, or excuse me, by Asada Shakur, not the late. Next we read Ben Tillman and the Reconstruction of White Supremacy by Stephen Kantrowitz. Next, Katrina After the Flood by Gary Rivlin. Gary Rivlin, I think, is still the only author where we read their book on the book club and also had him as a guest on the program. Next we read Between the World and Me, Ta-Nehisi Coates. Next, we read The Half Has Never Been Told by Edward Baptist. Next, A Foot in Each World by Leonida McLean. Next, also, Top 5 Selection for Gus T. Renegade, Medical Apartheid by Harriet A. Washington, one of my favorites. Next up, we read Blood Brothers, The Fatal Friendship Between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X by Randy Roberts and Johnny Smith. Next, we read The Spook Who Sat by the Door by the late Sam Greenlee. Next, we read The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy, Lothrop Stoddard's work. Next, we read the late Gwen Ifill's The Breakthrough, The Politics of Race, dealing with the election of President Obama. Next, we read The Delectable Negro, Human Consumption and Homoeroticism Within U.S. Slave Culture by the late Vincent Woodard. Next, we read My Life, My Love, My Legacy by the late Coretta Scott King. Then we read The Last Holiday by the late Gil Scott Heron. And now we have 3 sessions left. Frantz Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth. As I stated before, there are very few things that I would say I am proud of as a victim of white supremacy. But that there book list, oh yeah, I am proud to say yes. These are the books that we have read thus far on the context of white supremacy. And every single one of them, we went cover to cover. I think Urugu is the only one, our first book, where folks read it on their own and then we came to discuss. But beyond that, all of the other books for the past 5 years, we have read them all cover to cover and dissected on the broadcast. That should inform any sort of criticism of Frantz Fanon's work, the body of work that we covered to get here. With that, we will get started. Frantz Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth, study session number 7, Context of White Supremacy.
I am ready to concede that on the plane of factual being, the past existence of an Aztec civilization does not change anything very much in the diet of the Mexican peasant of today. I admit that all the proofs of a wonderful Songhai civilization will not change the fact that today the Songhais are underfed and illiterate, thrown between sky and water with empty heads and empty eyes. But it has been remarked several times that this passionate search for a national culture, which existed before the colonial era, finds its legitimate reason in the anxiety shared by native intellectuals to shrink away from that Western culture in which they all risk being swamped, because they realize they are in danger of losing their lives and thus becoming lost to their people. These men, hot-headed and with anger in their hearts, relentlessly determined to renew contact once more with the oldest and most pre-colonial springs of life of their people. Let us go further. Perhaps this passionate research and this anger are kept up, or at least directed, by the secret hope of discovering, beyond the misery of today, beyond self-contempt, resignation, abjuration, some very beautiful and splendid era whose existence rehabilitates us both in regard to ourselves and in regard to others. I have said that I have decided to go further, perhaps unconsciously. The native intellectuals, since they could not stand wonderstruck before the histories of today's barbarity, decided to back further and to delve deeper down. And let us make no mistake, it was with the greatest delight that they discovered that there was nothing to be ashamed of in the past, but rather dignity, glory, and solemnity. The claim to a national culture in the past does not only rehabilitate that nation and serve as justification for the hope of a future national culture in the sphere of psychoaffective equilibrium, it is responsible for an important change in the native. Perhaps we have not sufficiently demonstrated that colonialism is not simply content to impose its rule upon the present and the future of a dominated country. Colonialism is not satisfied merely with holding a people in its grip and emptying the native's brain of all form and content. By a kind of perverted logic, it turns to the past of the oppressed peoples and distorts, disfigures, and destroys it. This work of devaluing pre-colonial history takes on a dialectical significance today. When we consider the efforts made to carry out the cultural estrangement so characteristic of the colonial epoch, we realize that nothing has been left to chance, and that the total result looked for by colonial domination was indeed to convince the natives that colonialism came to lighten their darkness. The effect consciously sought by colonialism was to drive into the natives' heads the idea that if the settlers were to leave, they would at once fall back into barbarism, degradation, and bestiality. On the unconscious plane, colonialism therefore did not seek to be considered by the native as a gentle, loving mother who protects her child from a hostile environment, but rather as a mother who unceasingly restrains her fundamentally perverse offspring from managing to commit suicide and from giving free rein to its evil instincts. The colonial mother protects her child from itself, from its ego, and from its physiology, its biology, and its own unhappiness, which is its very essence. In such a situation, the claims of the native intellectual are not a luxury, but a necessity in any coherent program. The native intellectual who takes up arms to defend his nation's legitimacy and who wants to bring proofs to bear out that legitimacy, who is willing to strip himself naked to study the history of his body, is obliged to dissect the heart of his people. Such an examination is not specifically national. The native intellectual who decides to give battle to colonial lies fights on the field of the whole continent. The past is given back its value. Culture, extracted from the past to be displayed in all its splendor, is not necessarily that of his own country. Colonialism, which has not bothered to put too fine a point on its efforts, has never ceased to maintain that the Negro is a savage. And for the colonists, the Negro was neither an Angolan nor a Nigerian, for he simply spoke of the Negro. For colonialism, this vast continent was the haunt of savages, a country riddled with superstitions and fanaticism, destined for contempt, weighed down by the curse of God, a country of cannibals, in short, the Negro's country. Colonialism's condemnation is continental in its scope. The contention by colonialism that the darkest night of humanity lay over pre-colonial history concerns the whole of the African continent. The efforts of the native to rehabilitate himself and to escape from the claws of colonialism are logically inscribed from the same point of view as that of colonialism. The native intellectual who has gone far beyond the domains of Western culture and who has got into his head to proclaim the existence of another culture never does so in the name of Angola or of Dahomey. The culture which is affirmed is African culture. The Negro, never so much a Negro as since he has been dominated by the whites, when he decides to prove that he has a culture and to behave like a cultured person, comes to realize that history points out a well-defined path to him. He must demonstrate that a Negro culture exists. And it is only too true that those who are most responsible for this racialization of thought, or at least for the first movement toward that thought, are and remain those Europeans who have never ceased to set up white cultures to fill the gap left by the absence of other cultures. Colonialism did not dream of wasting its time in denying the existence of one national culture after another. Therefore, the reply of the colonized peoples will be straightaway continental in its breadth. In Africa, the native literature of the last 20 years is not a national literature, but a Negro literature. The concept of negritude, for example, was the emotional, if not the logical, antithesis of that insult which the white man flung at humanity. This rush of negritude against the white man's contempt showed itself in certain spheres, to be the one idea capable of lifting interdictions and anathemas. Because the New Guinean or Kenyan intellectuals found themselves above all against a general ostracism and delivered to the combined contempt of their overlords, their reaction was to sing praises in admiration of each other. The unconditional affirmation of African culture has succeeded the unconditional affirmation of European culture. On the whole, the poets of negritude oppose the idea of an old Europe to a young Africa. Tiresome reasoning to lyricism, oppressive logic to high-stepping nature, and on one side stiffness, ceremony, etiquette, and skepticism, while on the other frankness, liveliness, liberty, and why not luxuriance, but also irresponsibility. The poets of negritude will not stop at the limits of the continent. From America, black voices will take up the hymn with fuller unison. The quote, black world will see the light. And Bousia from Ghana, Burago Diop from Senegal, Hampate Ba from the Sudan, and St. Clair Drake from Chicago will not hesitate to assert the existence of common ties and a motive power that is identical. The example of the Arab world might equally well be quoted here. We know that the majority of Arab territories have been under colonial domination. Colonialism has made the same effort in these regions to plant deep in the minds of the native population the idea that before the advent of colonialism, their history was one which was dominated by barbarism. The struggle for national liberty has been accompanied by a cultural phenomenon known by the name of the Awakening of Islam. The passion with which contemporary Arab writers remind their people of the great pages of their history is a reply to the lies told by the occupying power. The great names of Arabic literature and the great past of Arab civilization have been brandished about with the same ardor as those of the African civilizations. The Arab leaders have tried to return to the famous Dar el-Islam, which shone so brightly from the 12th to the 14th century. Today, in the political sphere, the Arab League is giving palpable form to this will to take up again the heritage of the past and to bring it to culmination. Today, Arab doctors and Arab poets speak to each other across the frontiers and strive to create a new Arab culture and a new Arab civilization. It is in the name of Arabism that these men join together and that they try to think together. Everywhere, however, in the Arab world, national feeling has preserved, even under colonial domination, a liveliness that we fail to find in Africa. At the same time, that spontaneous communion of each with all, present in the African movement, is not to be found in the Arab League. On the contrary, paradoxically, everyone tries to sing the praises of the achievements of his nation. The cultural process is freed from the indifferentiation which characterized it in the African world, but the Arabs do not always manage to stand aside in order to achieve their aims. The living culture is not national, but Arab. The problem is not as yet to secure a national culture, not as yet to lay hold of a movement differentiated by nations, but to assume an African or Arabic culture when confronted by the all-embracing condemnation pronounced by the dominating power. In the African world, as in the Arab, we see that the claims of the man of culture in a colonized country are all-embracing, continental, and in the case of the Arabs, worldwide. This historical necessity in which the men of African culture find themselves to racialize their claims and to speak more of African culture than of national culture will tend to lead them up a blind alley. Let us take, for example, the case of the African Cultural Society. This society had been created by African intellectuals who wished to get to know each other and to compare their experiences and the result of their respective research work. The aim of this society was therefore to affirm the existence of an African culture, to evaluate this culture on the plane of distinct nations, and to reveal the internal motive forces of each of their national cultures. But at the same time, this society fulfilled another need, the need to exist side by side with the European cultural society, which threatened to transform itself into a universal cultural society. There was therefore at the bottom of this decision the anxiety to be present at the universal trysting place, fully armed, with a culture springing from the very heart of the African continent. Now, this society will very quickly show its inability to shoulder these different tasks and will limit itself to exhibitionist demonstrations, while the habitual behavior of the members of this society will be confined to showing Europeans that such a thing as African culture exists and opposing their ideas to those of ostentatious and narcissistic Europeans. We have shown that such an attitude is normal and draws its legitimacy from the lies propagated by men of Western culture. But the degradation of the aims of this society will become more marked with the elaboration of the concept of negritude. The African society will become the cultural society of the black world and will come to include the Negro dispersion. That is to say, the tens of thousands of black people spread over the American continents. The Negroes who live in the United States and in Central or Latin America, in fact, experience the need to attach themselves to a cultural matrix. Their problem is not fundamentally different from that of the Africans. The whites of America did not mete out to them any different treatment from that of the whites who ruled over the Africans. We have seen that the whites were used to putting all Negroes in the same bag. During the first Congress of the African Cultural Society, which was held in Paris in 1956, the American Negroes of their own accord considered their problems from the same standpoint as those of their African brothers. Cultured Africans, speaking of African civilizations, decreed that there should be a reasonable status within the state for those who had formerly been slaves. But little by little, the American Negroes realized that the essential problems confronting them were not the same as those that confronted the African Negroes. The Negroes of Chicago only resemble the Nigerians or the Tanganyikans insofar as they were all defined in relation to the whites. But once the first comparisons had been made and subjective feelings were assuaged, the American Negroes realized that the objective problems were fundamentally heterogeneous. The test cases of civil liberty, whereby both whites and blacks in America try to drive back racial discrimination, have very little in common in their principles and objectives with the heroic fight of the Angolan people against the detestable Portuguese colonialism. Thus, during the Second Congress of the African Cultural Society, the American Negroes decided to create an American society for people of black cultures. Negritude, therefore, finds its first limitation in the phenomena which take account of the formation of the historical character of men. Negro and African Negro culture broke up into different entities because the men who wished to incarnate these cultures realized that every culture is first and foremost national, and that the problems which kept Richard Wright or Langston Hughes on the alert were fundamentally different from those which might confront Leopold Senghor or Jomo Kenyatta. In the same way, certain Arab states, though they had chanted the marvelous hymn of Arab Renaissance, had nevertheless to realize that their geographical position and the economic ties of their region were stronger even than the past that they wished to revive. Thus we find today the Arab states organically linked once more with societies which are Mediterranean in their culture. The fact is that these states are submitted to modern pressure and to new channels of trade, while the network of trade relations, which was dominant during the great period of Arab history, has disappeared. But above all, there is the fact that the political regimes of certain Arab states are so different and so far away from each other in their conceptions that even a cultural meeting between these states is meaningless. Thus we see that the cultural problem, as it sometimes exists in colonized countries, runs the risk of giving rise to serious ambiguities. The lack of culture of the Negroes, as proclaimed by colonialism, and the inherent barbarity of the Arabs ought logically to lead to the exaltation of cultural manifestations which are not simply national but continental and extremely racial. In Africa, the movement of men of culture is a movement toward the Negro-African culture or the Arab-Muslim culture. It is not specifically toward a national culture. Culture is becoming more and more cut off from the events of today. It finds its refuge beside a hearth that glows with passionate emotion, and from there makes its way by realistic paths, which are the only means by which it may be made fruitful, homogeneous, and consistent. If the action of the native intellectual is limited historically, there remains nevertheless the fact that it contributes greatly to upholding and justifying the action of politicians. It is true that the attitude of the native intellectual sometimes takes on the aspect of a cult or of a religion. But if we really wish to analyze this attitude correctly, we will come to see that it is symptomatic of the intellectual's realization of the danger that he is running in cutting his last moorings and of breaking adrift from his people. This stated belief in a national culture is in fact an ardent, despairing turning toward anything that will afford him secure anchorage. In order to ensure his salvation and to escape from the supremacy of the white man's culture, the native feels the need to turn backwards toward his unknown roots and to lose himself at whatever cost in his own barbarous people. Because he feels he is becoming estranged, that is to say, because he feels that he is the living haunt of contradictions which run the risk of becoming insurmountable, the native tears himself away from the swamp that may suck him down and accepts everything, decides to take all for granted and confirms everything, even though he may lose body and soul. The native finds that he is expected to answer for everything and to all comers. He not only turns himself into the defender of his people's past, he is willing to be counted as one of them. And henceforward, he is even capable of laughing at his past cowardice. This tearing away, painful and difficult though it may be, is however necessary. If it is not accomplished, there will be serious psycho-affective injuries, and the result will be individuals without an anchor, without a horizon, colorless, stateless, rootless, a race of angels. It will be also quite normal to hear certain natives declare, quote, "I speak as a Senegalese and as a Frenchman. I speak as an Algerian and as a Frenchman." The intellectual who is Arab and French, or Nigerian and English, when he comes up against the need to take on two nationalities, chooses, if he wants to remain true to himself, the negation of one of these determinations. But most often, since they cannot or will not make a choice, such intellectuals gather together all the historical determining factors which have conditioned them and take up a fundamentally, quote, universal standpoint. This is because the native intellectual has thrown himself greedily upon Western culture, Like adopted children who only stop investigating the new family framework at the moment when a minimum nucleus of security crystallizes in their psyche, the native intellectual will try to make European culture his own. He will not be content to get to know Rabelais and Diderot, Shakespeare and Edgar Allan Poe. He will bind them to his intelligence as closely as possible. La dame n'était pas sûre. Elle avait un mari très comme il fait. Que c'était Racine et Corneille, et Voltaire et Rousseau, et le père Hugo, et le Jean Mousset, et Guédé et Valet, et tant d'autres encore. But at the moment when the nationalist parties are mobilizing the people in the name of national independence, the native intellectual sometimes spurns these acquisitions which he suddenly feels make him a stranger in his own land. It is always easier to proclaim rejection than actually to reject. The intellectual, who through the medium of culture has filtered into Western civilization, who has managed to become part of the body of European culture, in other words, who has exchanged his own culture for another, will come to realize that the cultural matrix, which now he wishes to assume, since he is anxious to appear original, can hardly supply any figureheads which will bear comparison with those, so many in number and so great in prestige, of the occupying powers' civilization. History, of course, though nevertheless written by the Westerners and to serve their purposes, will be able to evaluate from time to time certain periods of the African past. But standing face to face with his country at the present time, and observing clearly and objectively the events of today throughout the continent, which he wants to make his own, the intellectual is terrified by the void, the degradation, and the savagery he sees there. Now he feels that he must get away from the white culture. He must seek his culture elsewhere, anywhere at all. And if he fails to find the substance of culture of the same grandeur and scope as displayed by the ruling power, the native intellectual will very often fall back upon emotional attitudes and will develop a psychology which is dominated by exceptional sensitivity and susceptibility. This withdrawal, which is due in the first instance to a begging of the question in his internal behavior mechanism and his own character, brings out above all a reflex and contradiction which is muscular. This is sufficient explanation of the style of those native intellectuals who decide to give expression to this phase of consciousness, which is in the process of being liberated. It is a harsh style, full of images, for the image is the drawbridge which allows unconscious energies to be scattered on the surrounding meadows. It is a vigorous style, alive with rhythms, struck through and through with bursting life. It is full of color, bronzed, sun-baked, and violent. This style, which in its time astonished the peoples of the West, has nothing racial about it, in spite of frequent statements to the contrary. It expresses above all a hand-to-hand struggle, and it reveals the need that man has to liberate himself from a part of his being which already contain the seeds of decay. Whether the fight is painful, quick, or inevitable, muscular action must substitute itself for concepts. If in the world of poetry this movement reaches unaccustomed heights, The fact remains that in the real world, the intellectual often follows up a blind alley. When at the height of his intercourse with his people, whatever they were or whatever they are, the intellectual decides to come down into the common paths of real life. He only brings back from his adventuring formulas, which are sterile and extreme. He sets a high value on the customs, traditions, and the appearances of his people, but his inevitable, painful experience only seems to be a banal search for exoticism. The Sarai becomes sacred, and shoes that come from Paris or Italy are left off in favor of pampoodies, while suddenly the language of the ruling power is felt to burn your lips. Finding your fellow countrymen sometimes means, in this phase, to will to be a nigger. Not a nigger like all other niggers, but a real nigger. A Negro. Just the sort of nigger that the white man wants you to be. Going back to your own people means to become a dirty wog, to go native as much as you can, to become unrecognizable, and to cut off those wings that before you had allowed to grow. The native intellectual decides to make an inventory of the bad habits drawn from the colonial world and hastens to remind everyone of the good old customs of the people. That people which he has decided contains all truth and goodness. The scandalized attitude with which the settlers who live in the colonial territory greet this new departure only serves to strengthen the natives' decision. When the colonialists, who had tasted the sweets of their victory over these assimilated people, realize that these men whom they considered as saved souls are beginning to fall back into the ways of niggers, the whole system totters. Every native won over, every native who had taken the pledge, not only marks a failure for the colonial structure when he decides to lose himself and to go back to his own side, but also stands as a symbol for the uselessness and the shallowness of all the work that has been accomplished. Each native who goes back over the line is a radical condemnation of the methods and of the regime. And the native intellectual finds in the scandal he gives rise to a justification and an encouragement to persevere in the path he has chosen. If we wanted to trace in the works of native writers the different phases which characterize this evolution, we would find spread out before us a panorama on three levels. In the first phase, the native intellectual gives proof that he has assimilated the culture of the occupying power. His writings correspond point by point with those of his opposite numbers in the mother country. His inspiration is European, and we can easily link up these works with definite trends in the literature of the mother country. This is the period of unqualified assimilation. We find in this literature, coming from the colonies, the Parnassians, the Symbolists, and the Surrealists. In the second phase, we find the native is disturbed. He decides to remember what he is. This period of creative work approximately corresponds to that immersion which we have just described. But since the native is not a part of his people, since he only has exterior relations with his people, he is content to recall their life only. Past happenings of the bygone days of his childhood will be brought up out of the depths of his memory. Old legends will be reinterpreted in the light of a borrowed aestheticism and of a conception of the world which was discovered under other skies. Sometimes this literature of just before the battle is dominated by humor and by allegory, but often, too, it is symptomatic of a period of distress and difficulty, where death is experienced and discussed, too. We spew ourselves up, but already underneath, laughter can be heard. Finally, in the third phase, which is called the fighting phase, the native, after having tried to lose himself in the people and with the people, will on the contrary shake the people. Instead of according the people's lethargy an honored place in his esteem, he turns himself into an awakener of the people. Hence comes a fighting literature, a revolutionary literature, and a national literature. During this phase, a great many men and women, who up till then would never have thought of producing a literary work, now that they find themselves in exceptional circumstances, in prison, with the Marquis, or on the eve of their execution, feel the need to speak to their nation, to compose the sentence which expresses the heart of the people, and to become the mouthpiece of a new reality in action. The native intellectual, nevertheless, sooner or later will realize that you do not show proof of your nation from its culture, but that you substantiate its existence in the fight which the people wage against the forces of occupation. No colonial system draws its justification from the fact that the territories it dominates are culturally non-existent. You will never make colonialism blush for shame by spreading out little-known cultural treasures under its eyes. At the very moment when the native intellectual is anxiously trying to create a cultural work, he fails to realize that he is utilizing techniques and language which are borrowed from the stranger in his country. He contents himself with stamping these instruments with a hallmark which he wishes to be national, but which is strangely reminiscent of exoticism. The native intellectual who comes back to his people by way of cultural achievements behaves, in fact, like a foreigner. Sometimes he has no hesitation in using a dialect in order to show his will to be as near as possible to the people. But the ideas that he expresses and the preoccupations he is taken up with have no common yardstick to measure the real situation which the men and the women of his country know. The culture that the intellectual leans toward is often no more than a stock of particularisms. He wishes to attach himself to the people, but instead he only catches hold of their outer garments, and these outer garments are merely the reflection of a hidden life, teeming and perpetually in motion. That extremely obvious objectivity which seems to characterize a people is in fact only the inert, already forsaken result of frequent and not always very coherent adaptations of a much more fundamental substance which itself is continually being renewed. The man of culture, instead of setting out to find this substance, will let himself be hypnotized by these mummified fragments, which, because they are static, are in fact symbols of negation and outworn contrivances. Culture has never the translucidity of custom. It abhors all simplification. In its essence, it is opposed to custom, for custom is always the deterioration of culture. The desire to attach oneself to tradition, or bring abandoned traditions to life again, does not only mean going against the current of history, but also opposing one's own people. When a people undertakes an armed struggle or even a political struggle against a relentless colonialism, the significance of tradition changes. All that has made up the technique of passive resistance in the past may, during this phase, be radically condemned. In an underdeveloped country, during the period of struggle, traditions are fundamentally unstable and are shot through by centrifugal tendencies. This is why the intellectual often runs the risk of being out of date. The peoples who have carried on the struggle are more and more impervious to demagogy, and those who wish to follow them reveal themselves as nothing more than common opportunists. In other words, latecomers. In the sphere of plastic arts, for example, the native artist who wishes, at whatever cost, to create a national work of art shuts himself up in a stereotyped reproduction of details. These artists, who have nevertheless thoroughly studied modern techniques and who have taken part in the main trends of contemporary painting and architecture, turn their backs on foreign culture, deny it, and set out to look for a true national culture, setting great store on what they consider to be the constant principles of national art. But these people forget that the forms of thought and what it feeds on, together with modern techniques of information, language, and dress, have dialectically reorganized the people's intelligences, and that the constant principles which acted as safeguards during the colonial period are now undergoing extremely radical changes. The artist who has decided to illustrate the truths of the nation turns paradoxically toward the past and away from actual events. What he ultimately intends to embrace are, in fact, the cast-offs of thought, its shells and corpses, a knowledge which has been stabilized once and for all. But the native intellectual who wishes to create an authentic work of art must realize that the truths of a nation are, in the first place, its realities. He must go on until he has found the seething pot out of which the learning of the future will emerge. Before independence, the native painter was insensible to the national scene. He set a high value on non-figurative art, or more often specialized in still lifes. After independence, his anxiety to rejoin his people will confine him to the most detailed representation of reality. This is representative art, which has no internal rhythms, and art which is serene and immobile, evocative not of life but of death. Enlightened circles are in ecstasies when confronted with this, quote, inner truth, which is so well expressed. But we have the right to ask if this truth is in fact a reality, and if it is not already outworn and denied, called in question by the epoch through which the people are treading out their path toward history. In the realm of poetry, we may establish the same facts. After the period of assimilation characterized by rhyming poetry, the poetic tom-tom's rhythms break through. This is a poetry of revolt, but it is also descriptive and analytical poetry. The poet ought, however, to understand that nothing can replace the reason, irrevocable taking up of arms on the people's side. Let us quote De Pestre one more. The lady was not alone. She had a husband who knew everything, but to tell the truth, knew nothing. For you can't have culture without making concessions. You concede your flesh and blood to it. You concede your own self to others. By conceding, you gain. Classicism and romanticism and all that our souls are steeped in. The native poet who is preoccupied with creating a national work of art and who is determined to describe his people fails in his aim, for he is not yet ready to make that fundamental concession that De Pestre speaks of. The French poet, René Char, shows his understanding of the difficulty when he reminds us that the poem emerges out of a subjective imposition and an objective choice. A poem is the assembling and moving together of determining original values in contemporary relation with someone that these circumstances bring to the front. Yes, the first duty of the native poet is to see clearly the people he has chosen as the subject of his work of art. He cannot go forward resolutely unless he first realizes the extent of his estrangement from them. We have taken everything from the other side, and the other side gives us nothing unless by a thousand detours we swing finally round in their direction, unless by 10,000 wiles and 100,000 tricks they manage to draw us toward them, to seduce us and to imprison us, taking means in nearly every case being taken. Thus it is not enough to try to free oneself by repeating proclamations and denials. It is not enough to try to get back to the people in that past out of which they have already emerged. Rather, we must join them in that fluctuating movement which they are just giving a shape to, and which, as soon as it has started, will be the signal for everything to be called in question. Let there be no mistake about it. It is to this zone of occult instability where the people dwell that we must come. And it is there that our souls are crystallized, and that our perceptions and our lives are transfused with light. Keita Fodiba, today Minister of Internal Affairs in the Republic of Guyana, when he was director of the African Ballot, did not play any tricks with the reality which the people of Guyana offered him. He reinterpreted all the rhythmic images of his country from a revolutionary standpoint. But he did more. In his poetic works, which are not well known, we find a constant desire to define accurately the historic moments of the struggle and to mark off the field in which were to be unfolded the actions and ideas around which the popular will would crystallize. Here is a poem by Keita Fodiba, which is a true invitation to thought, to demystification, and to battle. African Dawn. Dawn was breaking. The little village, which had danced half the night to the sound of its tom-toms, was waking slowly. Ragged shepherds, playing their flutes, were leading their flocks down into the valley. The girls of the village, with their canaries, followed one by one along the winding path that leads to the fountain. In the marabout's courtyard, a group of children were softly chanting in chorus some verses from the Quran. Dawn was breaking. Dawn, the fight between night and day. But the night was exhausted and could fight no more, and slowly died. A few rays of the sun, the forerunners of this victory of the day, still hovered on the horizon, pale and timid, while the last stars gently glided over the mass of clouds, crimson like the blooming, flamboyant flowers. Dawn was breaking, and down at the end of the vast plain, with its purple contours, the silhouette of a bent man tilling the ground could be seen. The silhouette of Naaman the laborer. Each time he lifted his hoe, the frightened birds rose and flew swiftly away to find the quiet banks of the Joliba, the great Niger River. The man's gray cotton trousers, soaked by the dew, flapped against the grass on either side. Sweating, unresting, always bent over, he worked with his hoe, for the seed had to be sown before the next rains came. Dawn was breaking, still breaking. The sparrows circled amongst the leaves, announcing the day. On the damp track leading to the plain, a child, carrying his little quiver of arrows round him like a bandolier, was running breathless toward Naaman. He called out, "Brother Naaman, the headman of the village wants you to come to the council tree." The laborer, surprised by such a message so early in the morning, laid down his hoe and walked toward the village, which now was shining in the beams of the rising sun. Already the old men of the village were sitting under the tree, looking more solemn than ever. Beside them, a man in uniform, a district guard, sat impassively, quietly smoking his pipe. Naaman took his place on the sheepskin. The headman's spokesman stood up to announce to the assembly the will of the old men. "The white men have sent a district guard to ask for a man from the village who will go to war in their country. The chief men, after taking counsel together, have decided to send the young man who is the best representative of our race, so that he may go and give proof to the white man of that courage which has always been a feature of our manding." Naaman was thus officially marked out. For every evening the village girls praised his great stature and muscular appearance in musical couplets. Gentle Khadija, his young wife, overwhelmed by the news, suddenly ceased grinding corn, put the mortar away under the barn, and without saying a word, shut herself into a hut to weep over her misfortune with the stifled sobs. For death had taken her first husband, and she could not believe that now the white people had taken Naaman from her. Naaman, who was the center of all her new-sprung hopes. The next day, in spite of her tears and lamentations, the full-toned drumming of the war tom-toms accompanied Naaman to the village's little harbor, where he boarded a trawler, which was going to the district capital. That night, instead of dancing in the marketplace as they usually did, the village girls came to keep watch in Naaman's outer room, and there told their tales until morning around a wood of fire. Several months went by without any news of Naaman reaching the village. Khadija was so worried that she went to the cunning fetish worker from the neighboring village. The village elders themselves held a short secret council on the matter, but nothing came of it. At last, one day, a letter from Naaman came to the village, to Khadija's address. She was worried as to what was happening to her husband, and so that same night she came, after hours of tired walking, to the capital of the district, where a translator read the letter to her. Naaman was in North Africa. He was well And he asked for news of the harvest, of the feastings, the river, the dances, the council tree. In fact, for news of all the village. That night, the old women of the village honored Kadia by allowing her to come to the courtyard of the oldest women and listen to the talk that went on nightly among them. The headman of the village, happy to have heard news of Naaman, gave a great banquet to all the beggars of the neighborhood. Again, several months went by, and everyone was once more anxious, for nothing more was heard of Naaman. Kadia was thinking of going again to consult the fetish worker when she received a second letter. Naaman, after passing through Corsica and Italy, was now in Germany and was proud of having been decorated. But the next time there was only a postcard to say that Naaman had been made prisoner by the Germans. This news weighed heavily on the village. The old men held council and decided that henceforward Naaman would be allowed to dance the Duga, that sacred dance of the vultures that no one who has not performed some outstanding feat is allowed to dance. That dance of the Malai emperors, of which every step is a stage in the history of the Malai race. Kadia found consolation in the fact that her husband had been raised to the dignity of a hero in his country. Time went by. A year followed another, and Naaman was still in Germany. He did not write anymore. One fine day, the village headman received word from Dakar that Naaman would soon be home. The mutter of the tom-toms was at once heard. There was dancing and singing till dawn. The village girls composed new songs for his homecoming. For the old men who were the devotees of the Duga spoke no more about that famous dance of the Manding. But a month later, Corporal Musa, a great friend of Naaman's, wrote a tragic letter to Kadia. Dawn was breaking. We were at Tiroir-sur-Mer. In the course of a widespread dispute between us and our white officers from Dakar, a bullet struck Naaman. He lies in the land of Senegal. Yes, dawn was breaking. The first rays of the sun hardly touched the surface of the sea as they gilded its little foam-flecked waves. Stirred by the breeze, the palm trees gently bent their trunks down toward the ocean, as if saddened by the morning's battle. The crows came in noisy flocks to warn the neighborhood. By their cawing of the tragedy that was staining the dawn at Tiroir with blood, and in the flaming blue sky just above Naaman's body, a huge vulture was hovering heavily. It seemed to say to him, "Naaman, you have not danced the dance that is named after me. Others will dance it."
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast. Hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Our first segment on Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth. We'll pick up, he has a little bit more to say on the poem once we pick up with the second audio segment. For me, this is at 2:30, I guess, bottom of 2:30. For me, I guess it might vary a little bit depending on which version of the text you have. At any rate, if you would like to participate, the number to dial 641-715-3640. The code 564. 1-800-943-POUND. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. Code 564-943-POUND. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you do not want to use your phone, but you still want to join in, you can use the free VOPE line. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tinytiny.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. Address again, tinytiny.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. When you enter that address, click on the link. It's on the left of the page. It says free VOPE line. When you click that link, it will open a small window on your screen. Top line, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can press, you can type in your real name, nickname, you can press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live program. It is the same procedure if you would like to participate. You'll see the dial pad. Press star 6. We will get you on the line, and you can share whatever thoughts you have. There were a few tidbits that I thought were significant today. I'll get to those. We have about 2 sessions left, so if you have concluding thoughts, that would be grand as always. Why are white people so pleased about this text? And if we have any of the folks who recommended this book, what did you think you were going to get from the text? What have you actually gotten from the text? Or what did you anticipate the text being like based on what you'd heard, or just, you know, whatever you had attached to this book prior to us reading it? And now that we're 2 sessions from concluding, what's actually in the book? That would be grand. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free if you have commentary you'd like to share. Oh, Mr. Dimery 4, folks are lollygagging. If you have commentary, Mr. Dimery 4 should be with us.
Yes, greetings, Gus. I'm hanging in here. First, you know, I'd like to comment on the fact that it was a phrase here. It said, yes, everyone must be involved in the struggle for the sake of the common salvation. There are no clean hands, no innocent bystanders. We are all in the process of dirtying our hands in the quagmire of our soil and the terrifying void in our minds. Any bystanders is a coward or a traitor. You know, and in a way that kind of sums it up when you're learning about racism and counter-racism. You know, when you get this knowledge, I mean, it's hard enough to grasp the concept, but then when you get it, then you must try to do something with it. You know, it's try to help solve the problem of white supremacy, racism, or help some other victim in some type of way. Because we all, you know, we're in it, whether we realize it or not, and your response to racism is basically going to be, you know, define who you are. So there's no standing around and, you know, you're either doing something or you're just going along with it. And another part, when he was talking about this African president, was doing a speech at the Congress of African Writers. You know, it sounded good. He said, In the realm of thought, man can claim to be the brain of the world. But in reality, where every action affects spiritual and physical being, the world is still the brain of mankind. For it is here that are concentrated the totalization of powers and elements of thought and dynamic forces of development and improvement. And it is here, too, that energies are merged and the sum total of man's intelligent values is finally inscribed. And I think we learned that from Dr. Anee's book, Urugu, when she was saying how white people was devoid of a spirituality. So it's that spiritual void, too, that we have to deal with. And then African people, people with melanated skin, have a spiritual connectiveness, you know, whereas, you know, we have been able to call upon some spiritual powers to maybe help us endure because it hadn't helped us solve the problem yet. The next, it says, the army is never a school for war, but a school for civics, a school for politics. The soldier in a mature nation is a mercenary, is not a mercenary, but a citizen who defends the nation by the use of arms. And if you think about it, when, well, I joined the military. Most young men, you know, during my time when I was growing up, you had about three choices. You take college, join the military, or, you know, end up, you know, incarcerated, greater confinement, you know, but going into these, that's just another socialization process where they're molding you and brainwashing your form of thinking. But at the same time, you may get a few crumbs of benefits where, you know, you may work for the government afterwards, but, let's face it, you were a victim of, you know, some serious brainwash. You know, he covers a lot in the book, but what I actually found intriguing was how he was describing that if you knew about your ancient ancestors and the great empires, you know, that would do little for you now. When people, descendants of those people are starving and in those bony-like states with their eyes bugging out, you know, but the, and then he comes back, you know, to say, when you are imitating the colonizer or the European, then you want to come back and discover, you know, who your people are after you realize that you're never going to assimilate. You can imitate them, but it's never going to be any assimilation because of the skin coloration and the fact of what they, how they feel about black people globally. It is, you know, I think the book referred to you dirty. Mine said dirty nigger, you know, just a nigger. You know, whether, and then you have the conflict where there is the African Negro and then the American Negro, whereas a person is split between thinking that he's different from an African, but the white man is treating them all the same way. But this division that's going on inside of a person's mind starts to create, you know, a paradox and creates a problem and confusion and keeps you from understanding what's really going on. And last I said, a party said the whites in America has not behaved any differently to them than the white colonizers had to the Africans. We have seen how the whites were used to putting all Negroes or niggers, whatever you want to call it, in one basket. And I'll mute my line on that, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Appreciate that, Mr. Demery. I'm hanging in as well. We have other listeners out there, folks, who, particularly if this was a book you picked, if you have any thoughts, that would be grand as well. Some of the notes that I took from the section from this week. He did this last week. He's done this throughout the book where he says colonialism is not satisfied merely with holding a people in its grip and emptying the native's brain of all form and content. And he does this consistently where he is not labeling white people as the subject, as the oppressors, the ones that are doing the doing. It's colonialism, this kind of abstract, nebulous way of branding the folks responsible for abusing black people, holding black people in its grip and emptying them of their emptying their brains of all form and content. It's white people doing that worldwide. But I did think his point was important, even though he's not indicting white people explicitly, where he says, we realize that nothing has been left to chance and that the total result looked for by colonial domination was indeed to convince the natives that colonialism came to lighten their darkness. The effect consciously sought by colonialism, there it is again, was to drive into the natives' heads the idea that if the settlers were to leave, they would at once fall back into barbarism, degradation, and bestiality. I thought that was important and applicable to non-white people worldwide. I think that's been their effort to instill that. I think Dr. Ani talks about that in Yorugu in terms of they are supposed to be the source of salvation. Dr. Welsing talks about that regularly as well. Mr. Fuller, whites are supposed to be salvation. If they left, you know, the sun, everything would vanish and we would be, you know, in ruin. And they make an effort to project that on both ends. They will make an effort. You'll see a lot of images of black people suffering right now. If they show images of what's happening in the Caribbean, it'll be black people suffering and in poverty, just like they showed with the earthquake in 2010, with New Orleans in 2005. Like, they like to have that sort of image. And then we're going to get things cleaned up and get it right. Have some white people coming in that they're pretty standard with that effect worldwide. Let's see. Next thing I had. Where he says, this for me is on 2:11, and is only too true that those who are most responsible for this racialization of thought, or at least for the first movement toward that thought, are and remain those Europeans who have never ceased to set up white culture to fill the gap left by the absence of other cultures. Colonialism did not dream of wasting its time in denying the existence of one national culture after another. And he says where it's just this entire, the entire continent is a wasteland of Negroes. And we can just come in and fill it up with the way we want things to be and how we want you all to think that will be best for white power, white domination. I thought that was important. Where he's talking about this rush of negritude against the white man's contempt, this idea of embracing and defining your own blackness, where he says in Africa, the native literature of the last 20 years is not a national literature, but a Negro literature. The concept of negritude, for example, was the emotional, if not the logical, antithesis of that insult which the white man flung at humanity. And Leopold Sedar Senghor, and there are many other authors that are considered a part of this movement at this time period, I'd say around the 60s, 70s, in terms of writing for black readers and writing using black languages. This very popular and even content in terms of what you're actually subject matter, what you're actually writing about. It obviously did not solve the problem of racism, white supremacy, but there was a lot of literature into dudes, even reminding me it's similar of like black power in the United States has a similar feel, at least to my reading of it. Next, he mentions a little bit further down, where this notion was spreading worldwide, mentioning black people in the States. He says, from America, black voices will take up the hymn with fuller unison. The black world will see the light, and Bouja from Ghana, Barago, Diop from Senegal, Hamapte Ba from Sudan, and St. Clair Drake from Chicago. I did not know all of those names, most of those names. So I was trying to go check. Claire Drake from Chicago. He has since passed on, but he wrote a lot of material. He was a professor, a permanent instructor, in fact, at Stanford University. He also taught at Drexel in New Orleans, Louisiana, which I believe is an HBCU. This is from his obit in the New York Times. He passed away in 1990. June of 1990. They write, just missed the lynching rope. Or actually, I'll go back up and give a little more. St. Clair Drake, he graduated with honors in biology from Hampton Institute. His reading included works by black militants, probably like Fanon, and he joined Quaker activists traveling around the country in a campaign for world peace. His efforts prompted racist insults by whites. Several times, he just missed the lynching rope, he recalled, and he became dedicated to racial justice. He aided black tenant farmers and, on a fellowship, earned a doctoral degree in anthropology at the University of Chicago. In World War II, he served in the Merchant Marine instead of the regular armed forces to avoid segregation. And it goes on to give more information about who St. Clair Drake was. He died at the age of 79, and lists some of the many books that he wrote as well, some of them including Black Metropolis. I'll give you the full title in a second. A Study of Negro Life in a Northern City, Black Metropolis, that was published back in 1945. Folks want to do some digging. Back to Frantz Fanon, Wretched of the Earth. I have learned some things as we've been reading, even though I have griped. Says, little by little, the American Negroes realized that the essential problems confronting them were not the same as those that confronted the African Negroes. The Negroes of Chicago only resembled the Nigerians or the Tanganyikans insofar as they were all defined in relation to the whites. But once the first comparisons had been made and subjective feelings were assuaged, the American Negroes realized that the objective problems were fundamentally heterogeneous. The test cases of civil liberty, whereby both whites and blacks in America try to drive back racial discrimination, have very little in common in their principles and objectives with the heroic fight of the Angolan people against the detestable Portuguese colonialism. I thought that was interesting, just in saying that, no, what's happening in this part of the world is substantially different than what's happening in the continent, and that the black people are not experiencing the same type of oppression, particularly since at this period you had a lot of people, some of them that we've already mentioned today, Minister Malcolm X, Dr. King, Coretta Scott King, and many others. That was one of the main pieces of activism that they were engaged in saying that black people are facing the same type of oppression worldwide, and that we should see similarities in how black people are being oppressed, and him saying that, no, upon closer examination, it is not the same. There are a few similarities, but there are, you know, pretty substantial differences in how this is being meted out. I think my view would be more that the system of white supremacy, mostly the main points are pretty much the same in terms of how it operates and how it functions on the ground level. Obviously, that's going to change depending on where you are. It's not even going to be exactly the same. Even, you know, if you travel from Florida to Washington State, it's going to be substantially different, much less if you go to different parts of the globe. But most of the fundamentals in terms of who is in charge and how it's going to be operating, economics, what that's going to look like, lot of similarities. I would say many more similarities than differences once you get some of the main principles down that you understand about racism, white supremacy. But I am interested in hearing folks' thoughts on that one. Let's see. the whole ending, I guess, with the poem, I was not feeling. I said that when we did Gil Scott Heron the last holiday. I am so not a fan of poetry, and anytime we have books where we end up veering out of the text to have a long poetry recital, man, not a fan. And there was even music in the background. And this was kind of, it almost seemed like a short story as opposed to a poem, but you know, I guess that's all subjective anyway. But yeah, so not a fan. And even, I guess, this notion that somehow the national poets or whoever is selected for these titles, that somehow this will be a part of ending racism, white supremacy. And I just haven't seen that to be the case. I'm certainly a big advocate of what he talked about last week in terms of refining, improving communication between Black people. Absolutely. I don't know that poetry needs to be a part of that. I'm even reminded of Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, where she said, she was saying that it seems to be an established part of medical science that doing a lot of walking around and talking in rhyme is a symptom of mental illness. Words from a different psychiatrist. Let's see, anything else I want to make sure I get in? The part where he says that it can be difficult. I'll read what he says. He says, it will be also quite normal to hear certain natives declare, "I speak as a Senegalese and as a Frenchman. I speak as an Algerian and as a Frenchman." The intellectual who is Arab and French, or Nigerian and English, when he comes up against the need to take on two nationalities, chooses, if he wants to remain true to himself, the negation of one of these determinations. It's difficult for me to take a critique like that, even if there's some substance to it. It's difficult for me to take a critique like that and forget he is married to a white person. And I feel like there are a lot of critiques like that of Black people who are, to paraphrase or just to put it bluntly, selling out, or who are so enamored with white culture, where he goes on right below this to talk about how native intellectuals will not be content to get to know Rabelais or Diderot, Shakespeare, and Edgar Allan Poe. He will bind them to his intelligence as closely as possible. You can be no more closely bound than being in some sort of sexual arrangement with a white person, in my opinion. And I've said from the beginning, I don't know what the definition is, what the criterion is for a native intellectual, but man, Frantz Fanon would have to be close. Knowing that most Black people, or many, many Black people, the majority of Black people are denied quality education to become a psychiatrist, you have to get a lot of education. I know Dr. Welsing had a lot of schooling. So, yeah, that's just something that's difficult for me, or makes it difficult for me in reading Fanon, not just this book, but other works of his as well. I will pause there. Oh, wait a minute. One more thing I did think was important. When he says, this is on 219, when he says, now he feels that he must get away from the white culture. He must seek his culture elsewhere, anywhere at all. And if he fails to find the substance of culture of the same grandeur and scope as displayed by the ruling power, the native intellectual will very often fall back upon emotional attitudes and will develop a psychology which is dominated by exceptional sensitivity and susceptibility. This withdrawal, which is due in the first instance to a begging of the question in his internal behavior mechanism and his own character, brings out above all a reflex and contradiction which is muscular. A lot to kind of wade through, but I did think that that was important in talking about non-white people sometimes in our efforts to reject things that we associate with white people, conduct, behavior, whatever it is. In this effort to, Mr. Fuller says, that's law of compensation. If you're going to remove something, it's got to be replaced by something else. And what's going to replace that? He says a lot of being emotional. He also talked about reaching back and just trying to find some roots of culture, African culture, or whatever it is, and not even closely scrutinizing, is this going to help to solve this problem? Is what I'm replacing what I have deemed to be evil white culture, what I'm going to replace it with, is this an improvement? Very important. I think Toni Morrison has a just exquisite line in The Bluest Eye, where she talks about that, where there's frequently change but not improvement with black people in switching habits, which seems very applicable to this line here. But folks that are listening in, folks have any comments, particularly on the section where he talked about black people in the States having succinctly different problems, experiencing racism, oppression in an explicitly different manner than what black people are experiencing on the continent, and it need to be and for that to be articulated as such. Folks had thoughts on that, that would be great. Let's see, any other hands? Still not any hands from folks? Any other hands from folks who are listening in? If folks are laboring through this text, that I would even say is extremely important for how frequently you hear this text mentioned, or people say, oh my goodness, this is the Bible of black liberation. This is the book that you've just got to read in order to understand racism or to consider yourself a serious black scholar. You've got to read this book. And it seems, or I will speak for myself, it is a struggle. It is not something that I read with any excitement, and certainly not a book I would recommend. Even what does that say in terms of why this book is so ballyhooed and celebrated? The caller, see, last four digits, 5771, 5771. Did you have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. I came in a little late, the one thing that I've been always, and I think I said this like in the first 2 weeks of this reading of the text, is the translation. Obviously, the reading that's actually going on is from a different translation of what I have, which is from Richard Philcox. And I caught some phrases here that sound totally different. Well, I mean, if you look at it, it's like totally different. Like in the reading, they use the metaphor seeds of decay, but in my translation it says germs of decay. One other one that I caught was when they talked about fetish workers, but my translation says fetish priests. So, you know, workers and priests are two different things to me. So, you know, it gets confusing when you're trying to understand this text, along with, you know, the type of language that it's using. So, and you know, you just mentioned the Bible of, you know, a black revolutionary text. I mean, it's just like, to me, it's like the regular Bible, where you have like 300 different translations. So the thing is that what translation you're using. So I think this is one of the key issues I have, you know, as I'm following along with the different translation, you know, which one do you follow? Because like I said, seeds and germs are two different things. I may be wrong. I'm not a scientist, but you know, that's something that you know you have to think about. And also, you mentioned about the first gentleman that called when he said that the whites in America had not behaved differently to them than the white colonizers had in Africa. So I think that was very important because white supremacy is all over the globe. And you know, and the rest of the sentence says, we have seen how the whites were used, putting all Negroes in the same basket. And that's exactly how we are treated. And not just black people, but all non-white people across the globe. That's it for now. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that. Great point. Priests are not workers. A great point about the translation. Which, you know, we just talked about before. There's just a lot of things that would give me pause to see this book celebrate, and particularly to have so many white people just expressed joy and adulation about this text. Gives me great reservation. Do you have other folks any additional comments they wanted to make sure they get in? Don't see any other hands from folks. If folks don't have any additional comments, we can go ahead and get to the second audio segment quicker, get through that, and then once that's done, if folks have any additional comments, they can share it. Anything else folks wanted to get in before we get to the second audio segment?
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, a couple of things. You mentioned this, the part where it said the result was to hammer into the heads of the indigenous population that if the colonists were to leave, they would regress into barbarism, degradation, and bestiality. That same concept, you know, to instill fear into the minds of non-white people through the terrorism that they perpetrate on unarmed black men nowadays, and that those fear tactics all through the years, you know, is to instill that fear to keep you paralyzed to where you won't take action against solving this problem that we have. And then there's another part, the great names of Arabic literature has been recorded and the past of Arab civilization has been banished with the same zeal and order that as that of the African civilizations. And I disagree with that. I think it's like Dr. Wells has said, you know, it's that colorism, you know, the more melanin that you have in your skin, the worse you're going to be treated. And that seems to be consistent. And black people have even suffered at the hands of Arabs themselves. So I don't think that anyone has suffered at the hands of whites greater than non-white black people. And to answer to your question, you know, I used to believe that if an African, a Native African, you know, came to this country and, you know, he was educated, he came here, set up, you know, he has a country, say, from Nigeria. He knows his a little bit more of his ancestry, his background, this and that, whereas African-Americans lost all our history and then were programmed to think that our history started with slavery, the antebellum South. You know, it has to have some type of impact or different on the mindset, but in reality, you know, we all, you know, in the same boat, and we should try to come together or come up with some method, you know, of countering. I'll mute my line. Thanks.
Great point, Mr. Demery, for try to come up with some method of solving this problem as soon as possible, that the task that is facing all of us presently. Also reminded me of Dr. Welsing, black, get back. Absolutely, I would agree. Darker you are, the worse you are going to be. Mistreated, abused, terrorized. Do we have any other folks just looking out before we get to the second audio segment? If folks want to respond to any of the questions, they can feel free with that as well. Particularly the one where he has that section where he talks about how the problems that black people in the States were facing were different. He didn't imply who had it worse or anything, but just that they were substantially different from what was happening to black people in other parts of the world, that they warranted separate delineation in terms of explaining what was happening here as opposed to what, you know, folks were going through in other parts of the world. If folks had thoughts on that, would love to hear it. Anything else folks wanted to get in? Be satisfied? I will assume folks are good for now. We will get to the second audio segment. We should have ample time once this section concludes. So if folks do have additional comments that they would like to add, just jot a note so that you don't forget. We are resuming Frantz Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth. So this is right after the conclusion of the poem, whichever copy version of the book you have, if you're following along. So right after the poem concludes, and he's picking up and giving a short analysis, some of his thoughts on the poem that we heard at the end of the first segment. This is Frantz Fanon, Wretched of the Earth, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number 2.
If I have chosen to quote this long poem, it is on account of its unquestioned pedagogical value. Here, things are clear. It is a precise, forward-looking exposition. The understanding of the poem is not merely an intellectual advance, but a political advance. To understand this poem is to understand the part one has played, to recognize one's advance, and to furbish up one's weapons. There's not a single colonized person who will not receive the message that this poem holds. Naaman, the hero of the battlefields of Europe. Naaman, who eternally ensures the power and perenniality of the mother country. Naaman is machine gunned by the police force at the very moment that he comes back to the country of his birth. And this is Satif, 1945. This is Fort-de-France. This is Saigon, Dakar, and Lagos. All those niggas, all those wogs who fought to defend the liberty of France or for British civilization recognize themselves in this poem by Kieta Fodiba. But Kieta Fodiba sees further. In colonized countries, colonialism, after having made use of the natives on the battlefield, uses them as trained soldiers to put down the movements of independence. The ex-service associations are in the colonies one of the most anti-nationalist elements which exist. The poet Kieta Fodiba was training the Minister of Internal Affairs of the Republic of Guyana to frustrate the plots organized by French colonialism. The French Secret Service intend to use, among other means, the ex-servicemen to break up the young, independent Guyanan state. The colonized man who writes for his people ought to use the past with the intention of opening the future, as an invitation to action and a basis for hope. But to ensure that hope, and to give it form, he must take part in action and throw himself, body and soul, into the national struggle. You may speak about everything under the sun, but when you decide to speak of that unique thing in man's life that is represented by the fact of opening up new horizons, by bringing light to your own country, and by raising yourself and your people to their feet, then you must collaborate on the physical plane. The responsibility of the native man of culture is not a responsibility vis-a-vis his national culture, but a global responsibility with regard to the totality of the nation, whose culture merely, after all, represents one aspect of that nation. The culture native should not concern himself with choosing the level on which he wishes to fight, or the sector where he decides to give battle for his nation. To fight for national culture means, in the first place, to fight for the liberation of the nation, that material keystone which makes the building of a culture possible. There is no other fight for culture which can develop apart from the popular struggle. To take an example, all those men and women who are fighting with their bare hands against French colonialism in Algeria are not by any means strangers to the national culture of Algeria. The national Algerian culture is taking on form and content as the battles are being fought out in prisons, under the guillotine, and in every French outpost which is captured or destroyed. We must not, therefore, be content with delving into the past of a people in order to find coherent elements which will counteract colonialism's attempts to falsify and harm. We must work and fight with the same rhythm as the people to construct the future and to prepare the ground where vigorous shoots are already springing up. A national culture is not a folklore, nor an abstract populism that believes it can discover the people's true nature. It is not made up of inert dregs of gratuitous actions, that is to say, actions which are less and less attached to the ever-present reality of the people. A national culture is the whole body of efforts made by people in the sphere of thought to describe, justify, and praise the action through which that people has created itself and keeps itself in existence. A national culture in underdeveloped countries should therefore take its place at the very heart of the struggle for freedom which these countries are carrying on. Men of African cultures who are still fighting in the name of African Negro culture and who have called many congresses in the name of the unity of that culture should today realize that all their efforts amount to is to make comparisons between coins and sarcophagi. There is no common destiny to be shared between the national cultures of Senegal and Guyana. But there is a common destiny between the Senegalese and Guyanan nations, which are both dominated by the same French colonialism. If it is wished that the national culture of Senegal should come to resemble the national culture of Guyana, it is not enough for the rulers of the two peoples to decide to consider their problems, whether the problem of liberation is concerned, or the trade union question, or economic difficulties from similar viewpoints. And even here, there does not seem to be complete identity, for the rhythm of the people and that of their rulers are not the same. There can be no two cultures which are completely identical. To believe that it is possible to create a black culture is to forget that niggers are disappearing, just as those people who brought them into being are seeing the breakup of their economic and cultural supremacy. There will never be such a thing as black culture because there is not a single politician who feels he has a vocation to bring black republics into being. The problem is to get to know the place that these men mean to give their people, the kind of social relations that they decide to set up, and the conception that they have of the future of humanity. It is this that counts. Everything else is mystification, signifying nothing. In 1959, the cultured Africans who met at Rome never stopped talking about unity. But one of the people who was loudest in the praise of this cultural unity, Jacques Rabamanjara, is today a minister in the Madagascan government, and as such has decided with his government to oppose the Algerian people in the General Assembly of the United Nations. Rabamanjara, if he had been true to himself, ought to have resigned from the government and denounced those men who claim to incarnate the will of the Madagascan people. The 90,000 dead of Madagascar have not given Rabamanjara authority to oppose the aspirations of the Algerian people in the General Assembly of the United Nations. It is around the people's struggles that African Negro culture takes on substance, and not around songs, poems, or folklore. Senghor, who is also a member of the Society of African Culture, and who has worked with us on the question of African culture, is not afraid for his part either to give the order to his delegation to support French proposals on Algeria, adherence to African Negro culture, and to the cultural unity of Africa is arrived at in the first place by upholding unconditionally the people's struggle for freedom. No one can truly wish for the spread of African culture if he does not give practical support to the creation of the conditions necessary to the existence of that culture, in other words, to the liberation of the whole continent. I say again that no speech-making and no proclamation concerning culture will turn us from our fundamental task, the liberation of the national territory, a continual struggle against colonialism in its new forms, and an obstinate refusal to enter the charmed circle of mutual admiration at the summit. Reciprocal bases of national culture and the fight for freedom. Colonial domination, because it is total and tends to oversimplify, very soon manages to disrupt in spectacular fashion the cultural life of a conquered people. This cultural obliteration is made possible by the negation of national reality, by new legal regulations introduced by the occupying power, by the banishment of the natives and their customs to outlying districts by colonial society, by expropriation, and by the systematic enslaving of men and women. 3 years ago, at our first Congress, I showed that in the colonial situation, dynamism is replaced fairly quickly by a substantification of the attitudes of the colonizing power. The area of culture is then marked off by fences and signposts. These are, in fact, so many defense mechanisms of the most elementary type, comparable for more than one good reason to the simple instinct for preservation. The interest of this period for us is that the oppressor does not manage to convince himself of the objective non-existence of the oppressed nation and its culture. Every effort is made to bring the colonized person to admit the inferiority of his culture, which has been transformed into instinctive patterns of behavior, to recognize the unreality of his, quote, nation, and in the last extreme, the confused and imperfect character of his own biological structure. Vis-a-vis this state of affairs, the natives' reactions are not unanimous. While the mass of the people maintain intact traditions which are completely different from those of the colonial situation, and the artisanal style solidifies into formalism, which is more and more stereotyped, the intellectual throws himself in frenzied fashion into the frantic acquisition of the culture of the occupying power, and takes every opportunity of unfavorably criticizing his own national culture, or else takes refuge in setting out and substantiating the claims of that culture in a way that is passionate but rapidly becomes unproductive. The common nature of these two reactions lies in the fact that they both lead to impossible contradictions. Whether a turncoat or a substantialist, the native is ineffectual precisely because the analysis of the colonial situation is not carried out on strict lines. The colonial situation calls a halt to national culture in almost every field. Within the framework of colonial domination, there is not, and there will never be, such phenomena as new cultural departures or changes in the national culture. Here and there, valiant attempts are sometimes made to reanimate the cultural dynamic and to give fresh impulses to its themes, its forms, and its tonalities. The immediate, palpable, and obvious interest of such leaps ahead is nil. But if we follow up the consequences to the very end, we see that preparations are being made to brush the cobwebs off national consciousness, to question oppression, and to open up the struggle for freedom. A national culture under colonial domination is a contested culture whose destruction is sought in systematic fashion. It very quickly becomes a culture condemned to secrecy. This idea of a clandestine culture is immediately seen in the reactions of the occupying power, which interprets attachment to traditions as faithfulness to the spirit of the nation and as a refusal to submit. This persistence in following forms of cultures which are already condemned to extinction is already a demonstration of nationality, but it is a demonstration which is a throwback to the laws of inertia. There is no taking of the offensive and no redefining of relationships. There is simply a concentration on a hard core of culture which is becoming more and more shriveled up, inert, and empty. By the time a century or two of exploitation has passed, there comes about a veritable emaciation of the stock of national culture. It becomes a set of automatic habits, some traditions of dress, and a few broken-down institutions. Little movement can be discerned in such remnants of culture. There is no real creativity and no overflowing life. The poverty of the people, national oppression, and the inhibition of culture are one and the same thing. After a century of colonial domination, we find a culture which is rigid in the extreme, or rather, what we find are the dregs of culture, its mineral strata. The withering away of the reality of the nation and the death pangs of the national culture are linked to each other in mutual dependence. This is why it is of capital importance to follow the evolution of these relations during the struggle for national freedom. The negation of the native's culture, the contempt for any manifestation of culture, whether active or emotional, and the placing outside the pale of all specialized branches of organization contribute to breed aggressive patterns of conduct in the native. But these patterns of conduct are of the reflexive type. They are poorly differentiated, anarchic, and ineffective. Colonial exploitation, poverty, and endemic famine drive the native more and more to open, organized revolt. The necessity for an open and decisive breach is formed progressively and imperceptibly and comes to be felt by the great majority of the people. Those tensions which hitherto were non-existent come into being. International events, the collapse of whole sections of colonial empires, and the contradictions inherent in the colonial system strengthen and uphold the natives' combativity while promoting and giving support to national consciousness. These newfound tensions, which are present at all stages in the real nature of colonialism, have their repercussions on the cultural plane. In literature, for example, there is relative overproduction. From being a reply on a minor scale to the dominating power, the literature produced by natives becomes differentiated and makes itself into a will to particularism. The intelligentsia, which during the period of repression was essentially a consuming public, now themselves become producers. This literature at first chooses to confine itself to the tragic and poetic style, but later on novels, short stories, and essays are attempted. It is as if a kind of internal organization or law of expression existed which wills that poetic expression become less frequent in proportion as the objectives and the methods of the struggle for liberation become more precise. Themes are constantly altered. In fact, we find less and less of bitter, hopeless recrimination, and less also of that violent, resounding, florid writing which on the whole serves to reassure the occupying power. The colonialists have in former times encouraged these modes of expression and made their existence possible. Stinging denunciations, the exposing of distressing conditions and passions which find their outlet in expression, are in fact assimilated by the occupying power in a cathartic process. To aid such processes is, in a certain sense, to avoid their dramatization and to clear the atmosphere. But such a situation can only be transitory. In fact, the progress of national consciousness among the people modifies and gives precision to the literary utterances of the native intellectual. The continued cohesion of the people constitutes for the intellectual an invitation to go further than his cry of protest. The lament first makes the indictment, and then it makes an appeal. In the period that follows, the words of command are heard. The crystallization of the national consciousness will both disrupt literary styles and themes, and also create a completely new public. While at the beginning the native intellectual used to produce his work to be read exclusively by the oppressor, whether with the intention of charming him or of denouncing him through ethnic or subjectivist means, now the native writer progressively takes on the habit of addressing his own people. It is only from that moment that we can speak of a national literature. Here there is, at the level of literary creation, the taking up and clarification of themes which are typically nationalist. This may be properly called a literature of combat, in the sense that it calls on the whole people to fight for their existence as a nation. It is a literature of combat because it molds the national consciousness, giving it form and contours and flinging open before it new and boundless horizons. It is a literature of combat because it assumes responsibility and because it is the will to liberty expressed in terms of time and space. On another level, the oral tradition, stories, epics, and songs of the people, which formerly were filed away as set pieces, are now beginning to change. The storytellers who used to relate inert episodes now bring them alive and introduce into them modifications which are increasingly fundamental. There is a tendency to bring conflicts up to date and to modernize the kinds of struggle which the stories evoke. Together with the names of heroes and the types of weapons, the method of illusion is more and more widely used. The formula, quote, "This all happened long ago," is substituted with that of, quote, "What we are going to speak of happened somewhere else, but it might well have happened here today and might happen tomorrow," end quote. The example of Algeria is significant in this context. From 1952-53 on, the storytellers, who were before that time stereotyped and tedious to listen to, completely overturned their traditional methods of storytelling and the contents of their tales. Their public, which was formerly scattered, became compact. The epic, with its typified categories, reappeared. It became an authentic form of entertainment which took on once more a cultural value. Colonialism, made no mistake, when from 1955 on it proceeded to arrest these storytellers systematically. The contact of the people with the new movement gives rise to a new rhythm of life and to forgotten muscular tensions and develops the imagination. Every time the storyteller relates a fresh episode to his public, he presides over a real invocation. The existence of a new type of man is revealed to the public. The present is no longer turned in upon itself, but spread out for all to see. The storyteller once more gives free rein to his imagination. He makes innovations, and he creates a work of art. It even happens that the characters, which are barely ready for such a transformation, highway robbers or more or less antisocial vagabonds, are taken up and remodeled. The emergence of the imagination and of the creative urge in the songs and epic stories of a colonized country is worth following. The storyteller replies to the expectant people by successive approximations and makes his way, apparently alone but in fact helped on by his public, toward the seeking out of new patterns. That is to say, national patterns. Comedy and farce disappear or lose their attraction. As for dramatization, it is no longer placed on the plane of the troubled intellectual and his tormented conscience. By losing its characteristics of despair and revolt, the drama becomes part of the common lot of the people and forms part of an action in preparation or already in progress. Where handicrafts are concerned, the forms of expression which formerly were the dregs of art, surviving as if in a daze, now begin to reach out. Woodwork, for example, which formerly turned out certain faces and attitudes by the million, begins to be differentiated. The inexpressive or overwrought mask comes to life, and the arms tend to be raised from the body as if to sketch an action. Compositions containing 2, 3, or 5 figures appear. The traditional schools are led on to creative efforts by the rising avalanche of amateurs or of critics. This new vigor in this sector or cultural life very often passes unseen, and yet its contribution to the national effort is of capital importance. By carving figures and faces which are full of life, and by taking as its theme a group fixed on the same pedestal, the artist invites participation in an organized movement. If we study the repercussions of the awakening of national consciousness in the domains of ceramics and pottery making, the same observations may be drawn. Formalism is abandoned in the craftsman's work. Jugs, jars, and trays are modified. At first, imperceptibly, then almost savagely. The colors, of which formerly there were but few, and which obeyed the traditional rules of harmony, increase in number and are influenced by the repercussion of the rising revolution. Certain ochres and blues, which seemed forbidden to all eternity in a given cultural area, now assert themselves without giving rise to scandal. In the same way, the stylization of the human face, which according to sociologists is typical of very clearly defined regions, becomes suddenly completely relative. The specialists coming from the home country and the ethnologists are quick to note these changes. On the whole, such changes are condemned in the name of a rigid code of artistic style and of a cultural life which grows up at the heart of the colonial system. The colonialist specialists do not recognize these new forms and rush to the help of the traditions of the indigenous society. It is the colonialists who become the defenders of the native style. We remember perfectly, and the example took on a certain measure of importance, since the real nature of colonialism was not involved. The reactions of the white jazz specialist when, after the Second World War, new styles such as the bebop took definite shape. The fact is that in their eyes, jazz should only be the despairing, broken-down nostalgia of an old Negro who is trapped between 5 glasses of whiskey, the curse of his race, and the racial hatred of the white men. As soon as the Negro comes to an understanding of himself and understands the rest of the world differently, when he gives birth to hope and forces back the race's universe, it is clear that his trumpet sounds more clearly and his voice less hoarsely. The new fashions in jazz are not simply born of economic competition. We must without any doubt see in them one of the consequences of the defeat, slow but sure, of the southern world of the United States. And it is not utopian to suppose that in 50 years' time the type of jazz howl hiccuped by a poor misfortunate Negro will be upheld only by the whites who believe in it as an expression of negritude and who are faithful to this arrested image of a type of relationship. We might in the same way seek and find in dancing, singing, and traditional rites and ceremonies the same upward springing trend and make out the same changes in the impatience in this field. Well before the political or fighting phase of the national movement, an attentive speculator can thus feel and see the manifestation of new vigor and feel the approaching conflict. He will note unusual forms of expression and themes which are fresh and imbued with a power which is no longer that of invocation, but rather of the assembling of the people, a summoning together for a precise purpose. Everything works together to awaken the native sensibility and to make unreal and inacceptable the contemplative attitude or the acceptance of defeat. The native rebuilds his perceptions because he renews the purpose and dynamism of the craftsman, of dancing and music, and of literature and the oral tradition. His world comes to lose its accursed character. The conditions necessary for the inevitable conflict are brought together. We have noted the appearance of the movement in cultural forms, and we have seen that this movement and these new forms are linked to the state of maturity of the national consciousness. Now, this movement tends more and more to express itself objectively in institutions. From thence comes the need for a national existence, whatever the cost. A frequent mistake, and one which is moreover hardly justifiable, is to try to find cultural expressions for and to give new values to native culture within the framework of colonial domination. This is why we arrive at a proposition which at first sight seems paradoxical. The fact that in a colonized country, the most elementary, most savage, and the most undifferentiated nationalism is the most fervent and efficient means of defending national culture. For culture is, first, the expression of a nation, the expression of its preferences, of its taboos, and of its patterns. It is at every stage of the whole of society that other taboos, values, and patterns are formed. A national culture is the sum total of all these appraisals. It is the result of internal and external tensions exerted over society as a whole, and also at every level of that society. In the colonial situation, culture, which is doubly deprived of the support of the nation and of the state, falls away and dies. The condition for its existence is therefore national liberation and the renaissance of the state. The nation is not only the condition of culture, its fruitfulness, its continuous renewal, and its deepening. It is also a necessity. It is the fight for national existence which sets culture moving and opens to it the doors of creation. Later on, it is the nation which will ensure the conditions and framework necessary to culture. The nation gathers together the various indispensable elements necessary for the creation of a culture, those elements which alone can give it credibility, validity, life, and creative power. In the same way, it is its national character that will make such a culture open to other cultures and which will enable it to influence and permeate other cultures. A non-existent culture can hardly be expected to have bearing on reality or to influence reality. The first necessity is the re-establishment of the nation in order to give life to national culture in the strictly biological sense of the phrase. Thus we have followed the breakup of the old strata of culture, a shattering which becomes increasingly fundamental. And we have noticed, on the eve of the decisive conflict for national freedom, the renewing of forms of expression, and the rebirth of the imagination, there remains one essential question. What are the relations between the struggle, whether political or military, and culture? Is there a suspension of culture during the conflict? Is the national struggle an expression of a culture? Finally, ought one to say that the battle for freedom, however fertile, a posteriori, with regard to culture, is in itself a negation of culture? In short, is the struggle for liberation a cultural phenomenon or not? We believe that the conscious and organized undertaking by a colonized people to reestablish the sovereignty of that nation constitutes the most complete and obvious cultural manifestation that exists. It is not alone the success of the struggle which afterward gives validity and vigor to culture. Culture is not put into cold storage during the conflict. The struggle itself, in its development and in its internal progression, sends culture along different paths and traces out entirely new ones for it. The struggle for freedom does not give back to the national culture its former value and shapes. This struggle, which aims at a fundamentally different set of relations between men, cannot leave intact either the form or the content of the people's culture. After the conflict, there is not only the disappearance of colonialism, but also the disappearance of the colonized man. This new humanity cannot do otherwise than define a new humanism, both for itself and for others. It is prefigured in the objectives and methods of the conflict, a struggle which mobilizes all classes of the people, and which expresses their aims and their impatience, which is not afraid to count almost exclusively on the people's support, will of necessity triumph. The value of this type of conflict is that it supplies the maximum of conditions necessary for the development and aims of culture. After national freedom has been obtained in these conditions, there is no such painful cultural indecision which is found in certain countries which are newly independent, because a nation, by its manner of coming into being and in the terms of its existence, exerts a fundamental influence over culture. A nation which is born of the people's concerted action and which embodies the real aspirations of the people while changing the state cannot exist save in the expression of exceptionally rich forms of culture. The natives, who are anxious for the culture of their country and who wish to give to it a universal dimension, ought not therefore to place their confidence in the single principle of inevitable, undifferentiated independence written into the consciousness of the people in order to achieve their task. The liberation of the nation is one thing, the methods and popular content of the fight are another. It seems to us that the future of national culture and its riches are equally also part and parcel of the values which have ordained the struggle for freedom. And now it is time to denounce certain Pharisees. National claims, it is here and there stated, are a phase that humanity has left behind. It is the day of great concerted actions, and retarded nationalists ought in consequence to set their mistakes aright. We, however, consider that the mistake, which may have very serious consequences, lies in wishing to skip the national period. If culture is the expression of national consciousness, I will not hesitate to affirm that in the case with which we are dealing, it is the national consciousness which is the most elaborate form of culture. The consciousness of self is not the closing of a door to communication. Philosophic thought teaches us, on the contrary, that it is its guarantee. National consciousness, which is not nationalism, is the only thing that will give us an international dimension. This problem of national consciousness and of national culture takes on in Africa a special dimension. The birth of national consciousness in Africa has a strictly contemporaneous connection with African consciousness. The responsibility of the African as regards national culture is also a responsibility with regard to African Negro culture. This joint responsibility is not the fact of a metaphysical principle, but the awareness of a simple rule which wills that every independent nation in an Africa where colonialism is still entrenched is an encircled nation, a nation which is fragile and in permanent danger. If man is known by his acts, then we will say that the most urgent thing today for the intellectual is to build up his nation. This building up is true, that is to say, if it interprets the manifest will of the people and reveals the eager African peoples, then the building of a nation is of necessity accompanied by the discovery and encouragement of universalizing values. Far from keeping aloof from other nations, therefore, it is national liberation which leads the nation to play its part on the stage of history. It is at the heart of national consciousness that international consciousness lives and grows, and this twofold emerging is ultimately only the source of all culture. Statement made at the Second Congress of Black Artists and Writers, Rome, 1959.
Context of white supremacy. We have two sessions left on France Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth. Next week, we'll pick up the section Colonial War and Mental Disorders. That is for next Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If you have commentary you would like to share, the number to dial, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If folks have commentary, line should be open. If you have a hand up, feel free. If you have any commentary you would like to share, Mr. Franz Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth, Mr. Demery Ford should be with us. Other folks who dialed in the first time around, hand should be open. I will be on the lookout for other folks who have a hand up to share.
Okay, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, you did a lot of talk about culture, and according to Mr. Fuller, culture is just what people do. And so it seems confusing the way he talks about national consciousness, and then he throws in national consciousness along with the national culture. But he goes deeper in it when he's talking about black culture, and he makes a case on the fact that, you know, there can be nothing of a black culture, you know, not of any significance because of the oppression that you're feeling and the results of the oppression then would be your culture, which that's really not a culture. That's not the definition of it. Just your response to oppression that you feel, that you are experiencing. He never speaks about those who are oppressing others and colonialization, stop. Stop doing it. There's no evidence of that, and not even a mention of it. It says that colonial exploitation, poverty, and academic famine increasingly forces the colonized into the open, organized rebellion. So it's almost like it gets to a boiling point. You know, you put all these things that's happening to you, extreme poverty, and then you throw some famine in on top of it, like some hurricane coming in or some flood, you know, that grossly exacerbates your situation. And then you got a hellish situation. And then he goes into the literature, you know, I guess the way that media is manipulated to further the intentions of the colonizer, the persons who are oppressing the others. It says here the crystallization of the national consciousness will not only radically change the literary genres and themes, but also create a completely new audience. Whereas the colonized intellectual starts out by producing work exclusively with the oppressor in mind, either in order to charm him or to denounce him by using ethic and subjective categories, he gradually switches over to addressing himself to his people. So it's interesting that even when these intellectuals try to write about this and bring it out into consciousness, the pressure that he's feeling and on what he sees that he's accomplishing, well, actually trying to talk to the oppressor, he might as well just be talking to himself. And then it looks like he sells with just talking to his own people. And this is changing the literary system, because it says literary creation address and clarifies typically nationalist themes. This combat literature is the true sense of the word, in the sense that it calls upon the whole people to join in the struggle for the existence of a nation. You know, I guess you could look at the combat literature as propaganda, or what they would call propaganda, you know, the propaganda leaflets that they drop. And then he said, the way they tell stories, close attention should be paid to the emergence of imaginary and inventiveness in songs and folk tales in a colonized country. The storyteller responds to the expectation of the people by trial and error and searches for new models, national models, apparently on his own, but in fact with the support of his audience. Comedy and farce disappears or else loses their appeal. So it gets to the point that, you know, what you're doing, you know, it's been proven that in times of great distress or depression, people go to the movies more. They seek more entertainment. They probably want to go see a comedy show, try to escape reality. But in essence, after all that's over, you're still in the same place you were in. So that searching for an escape is real. But I think that's all I have on that, Gus. I'll mute my line now.
Appreciate that, Mr. Demery Four. If other folks, if you have commentary, feel free to chime in. As folks have spectated and not been robust with their participation, I suspect we will not be broadcasting the full 3 hours. So do not wait till the last minute if you think you have commentary you would like to share. One observation that I would note If you look on YouTube, there are 7 different videos for the audiobook of Wretched of the Earth. They're much larger sections. I think some of the videos are maybe 4 hours long. But if you look, lots of people listen to maybe the first 1 or 2. By the time you get to video 7, not too many people made it all the way through. Now, I understand that would likely be the case for a lot of videos, particularly when you have videos that are longer, 4 hours, that sort of thing. That might be the case. You would expect some dwindling off. But again, if this is supposed to be, you know, one of the most important, significant, recommended books in terms of addressing racism and analyzing problems confronting Black people, I mean, man, we should, you know, be willing to sit ourselves down, strap on our thinking cap, as they say, take notes, and if it requires reading it 4, 5, 6 times. I think it's been reported that Black Panther Party co-founder Huey P. Newton, that he read this book 6 times. I think Mumia Abu-Jamal said that in one of the audio segments that we played. If that's the case, man, there should be some payoff, and I just don't see it in the text. After which, regardless of which translation you get, and you labor through it, you dig through it. I mean, we read Yoruga. We have a pretty impressive reading list. We read Yoruga, which is also not the easiest read, but I mean, in my view, there is a substantial payoff with her text, and it's in my view, it's just a much more coherent text to read than what we got here. The second audio segment of what we read this week spent a lot of time focused on culture. I agree with what Mr. Demery Ford said, his quote to Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. It's been my experience that there have been a lot of books, conferences, seminars on culture. That's something that it seems like we get very excited to talk about, and or something that we have been programmed, groomed to talk about. And I just, at this point, everything that needs to be said about culture should have been said. We should already have that code together. There's no need to just continue to sit around and talk about culture and culture and culture and culture and culture for eons. And people act like that is the end-all be-all of everything that needs to be done. We just need to have, you know, 10 more seminars and sit around for another 500 hours talking about culture. I'd much rather just let's fast track this here thing. Mr. Fuller said, culture is what you do. And thus far, what we have been doing is a pitiful response to white terrorism. Absolutely. That is Black culture thus far that needs to be changed. You just go about evaluating what needs to be done. What are the things that we need to be doing? What are things that are not helping us get these things done? Maybe that should be discarded from quote unquote Black culture. He writes in, for me, this is on 235. In 1959, the cultured Africans who met at Rome never stopped talking about unity. But one of the people who was loudest in the praise of this cultural unity, Jacques Robin Mahera, is today a minister in the Madagascan government, and as such, has decided with his government to oppose the Algerian people in the General Assembly of the United Nations. Rob Mahara, if he had been true to himself, ought to have resigned from the government and denounced those men who claim to incarnate the will of the Madagascan people. The 90,000 dead of Madagascar have not given Rob Mahara authority to oppose the aspirations of the Algerian people in the General Assembly of the United Nations. And I feel like he's Fanon, he's made a lot of points throughout the text where, which I do think is constructive, where he's pointed out this kind of fairy tale notion of African unity, that just saying that doesn't bring it about. And in fact, pointing out how fickle it tends to be, that you can sit around and talk about all this, but then you still end up with a lot of Black people squabbling with one another, fighting with one another, where whites are not the issue. They might, you know, not even be physically present, but we're bickering and squabbling with each other. And there certainly continues to be a long record of that worldwide with non-white people. That's the sort of thing that I think is important. And, you know, as opposed to just sitting around and talking about African unity or Black unity or negritude or Black culture, getting down to specifics about what it is we should be doing, what it is we should not be doing, problems to be solved. I think that is much more in alignment with what we need. Continuing, he says, this is also in 234, I think, 235. I say again that no speech making and no proclamation concerning culture will turn us from our fundamental task, the liberation of the national territory, a continual struggle against colonialism in its new forms, and an obstinate refusal to enter the charmed circle of mutual admiration at the summit. Thought that was important as well, because this, you know, seems to be one of those points where he also is saying, it seems like I am seeing a lot of speechifying about culture and nationalism, as opposed to just getting down to rolling up our sleeves and going about the business at hand. What needs to be done? Black people have problems that need to be solved. Let's get to it. I also thought it was great, the line where he says, this is a little further down, this is on 243. He says, the fact is that in their eyes, jazz should only be despairing, broken down nostalgia of an old Negro who is trapped between five glasses of whiskey. And this is, he's talking about white jazz specialists who have this point of view. The curse of his race and the racial hatred of the white man. As soon as the Negro comes to an understanding of himself and understands the rest of the world differently, when he gives birth to hope and forces back the racist universe, it is clear that his trumpet sounds more clearly and his voice less hoarsely. The new fashions in jazz are not simply born of economic competition. We must, without any doubt, see in them one of the consequences of the defeat, slow but sure, of the southern world of the United States. And it is not utopian to suppose that in 50 years' time, the type of jazz howl hiccuped by a poor, misfortunate Negro will be upheld only by the whites who believe in it as an expression of negritude and who are faithful to this arrested image of a type of relationship. I thought that was a great quote. Even reminded me of Dr. Martin Kevorkian. He was on the program a week or so ago. Admitted white supremacist Dr. Kevorkian. He quoted Toni Morrison's line about some form of choked Africanness that whites like to have in their midst, whether it's a lawn jockey or it could be anything, a piece of kente cloth or some African artwork. In this instance, having some authentic jazz. It'll be, you know, you'll see tons of white people. They'll have every Miles Davis recording ever, even the most rare $5,000 piece, or you name it. Dizzy Gillespie, they'll have everything. Louis Armstrong, they'll have everything, the whole catalog. You've seen this, that, oh, this is real music. Forget all that nonsense, Jay-Z and no good Beyonce, you know, give me some Nina Simone. They'll have every single recording, live, studio pressing, everything, first edition, that same sort of thing. And I have to give credit for him to be able to accurately see that, although that pattern does repeat a lot, where you'll see from any generation. You'll probably be seeing that coming within the next 20, 30 years. If you're not seeing it already, the white people who say that they are hip hop, they're all about the hip hop nostalgia and back when it first started and the glory days, the 80s, 70s, whatever time period they want to put on. I'm sure you'll have that if you stick around the plantation long enough. You'll see that even play out. It's, I guess some point down the road it'll be, oh yeah, Beyonce, she was authentic Negro music, gotta love some Beyonce. That'll be what it is if you stick around long enough. But just noticing the patterns in terms of how white people behave, and regardless of what quote unquote black culture is, if you do not replace white supremacy with justice, racists will just consume it, devour it, and, you know, totally ruin it, as they have done with pretty much everything else. Unless folks had any other commentary they wanted to get in, any final comments, anything else that stood out from the section that we read. Again, only two sessions left and we will be done. I will be elated. We can move on. Stupid Talk, Crazy Talk, that is a book I'm elated about. Even if people didn't want to participate then, that is a book that I absolutely, just really, really enjoyed reading. Has a lot of constructive value directly related to why this program is called The Context of White Supremacy, and related to even what we talked about here, the importance of improving language, communication, That's what that book is all about. Tips, suggestions on how to refine our use of words, and particularly use of words so that you minimize conflict, especially unintended conflict. Man, looking forward, but we have 2 weeks to go. Anything else folks want to get in before we get ready to wrap things up? I will assume folks are satisfied. I will also, it could be people have just said, you know, if Gus is going to say that this isn't, he's not enjoying the text, then we won't participate or join in. I guess that could be the case. I tend to think that other people have had a difficult time listening to this book. I tend to think other people have just said, man, it is tough to read. And as even some of the folks who called in said that they felt like they weren't getting a whole lot from the text. It's not quite what they expected. That should be thought about. I think that's extremely important. This is not some book that is, you know, difficult to find or some rarity. I think this is a book, one of the most referenced books when it comes to racism, especially from the lips of white people, powerful white people, professors, instructors, and what have you, who have college curriculums, point to this book and say, oh yeah, you should read it. This will help your understanding of what's happening right now. You can even connect this to Black Lives Matter. That should be profound, you know, that people even picking this text up and saying, man, I don't even have an interest in finishing the text because I'm just not getting anything from it. Looking at all of the works that we've read before, we've read texts that were much longer than this. We've read texts that were written by authors outside the country, and we've read texts that, in my opinion, were just as challenging to understand for different reasons, and we stuck it out. This one here stands alone. That says a lot. With that, we'll be here tomorrow. Compensatory call in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Tune in. We will review what's gone down last week on the plantation. Looking forward to exchanging views. We'll also be here on Monday. Dr. Amanti Shakti Ani, she'll be here on Monday. She was with us at the beginning of the year. We were talking about the University of Albany 3, the case, these young black female students, they were assaulted on a bus. This was like way back in 2016 when this happened. It's been almost 2 years. They were assaulted on this bus by these drunken white urchins. They were teens, I guess, younger white people. And the black students, these three black females, they were the only ones who were charged with any sort of criminal activity or what have you. This whole thing played out for like the last year and a half. They got disciplined from the school, suspelled, expulsions, went to court, community service, and all this other nonsense. But we'll get the update on Monday, as well as how the University of Albany has also retaliated against Dr. Ani. She was one of the professors who was very vocal in coming out to support these three students. So we'll get the update on all that. That is this coming Monday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific here on the COWS. If you have questions, guest suggestions, you can't find something in the archives, other commentary you want to share, untiljustice@gmail.com. Untiljustice@gmail.com. Drop a message. Again, if you dropped the message over the last month and a half when I was going through my back issues and wisdom teeth extractions, my email certainly got clogged as I was suffering. So if you can be patient as I attempt to catch myself up. You can also just feel free to email again if you know you think that would be easier. That said, again, first day of autumn. If you're out and about, celebrating the equinox and the new season, grand. Just stay sober. You do not want to be out frolicking and then all of a sudden be stunned with the presence of a race soldier, badge or no, where you might have to make a life-saving decision quickly. I don't think being under the influence is going to help you in that situation. I think Dr. Welsing, many others, they would encourage us to take care of our brain computer, remain sober, so that we can think at the highest level to crank out solutions to solve this problem. White people, the system of white supremacy, and I think we might be able to best do that being sober. That said, buckle up if you're going to be behind the wheel, driver or passenger. Buckle up. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.